Even now, when we look up at the moon on a warm summer's night, those memories come flooding back, and we think those were some talented and smart and fearless people.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop. We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
And welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. My thanks to Becky for filling in for me for a few days. It's nice to be back. And while I was out, I was able to watch some TV. And I watched CNN's wonderful documentary on the Apollo program. And it features archival footage. If you have a chance to check it out this weekend, it's worth the time. And it'll probably give you some greater insight into what we're talking about today. And that is, as we all know, it's been 50 years. Can you believe it? 50 years since man first landed and then walked on the moon. Today, we're going to discuss how some of the men and women in our region helped get us there. But we're going to start by bringing in Bill Finch. Bill calls himself a recovering politician. He's the former mayor of Bridgeport, Connecticut's largest city in terms of population, and he's now the executive director of the Discovery Museum, which is right down the road from our radio station, from WSHU. Bill, always good to see you.
Good to see you, Ron.
You have a special exhibit about Apollo 11.
We do. You could say the whole museum is dedicated to Apollo 11. It's an interactive set of exhibits. It's a planetarium. It's a Challenger mission, a Challenger Learning Center, science on a sphere. You know, kids from all over Fairfield, New Haven, and Westchester County come there with their families. About 60,000 to 70,000 people a year come through the doors. And we are walking on air right now because it's the 50th anniversary and everybody's so charged up. Saturday, the 20th, will be a free day sponsored by Pitney Bowes, all dedicated to the Apollo 11 mission.
I was telling you off the air, I think I'm going to swing by with my great nephews. I mean, I think but it's for kids of all ages, isn't it?
Yeah, they say it's a children's museum. I said, yes, children from 1 to 100, and I got in trouble. A 101-year-old lady said, what about her? I was like, okay, yeah, you too, ma'am. I'm sorry.
This is when you're happy that you're no longer a politician.
I lost a vote there. I'll try to get it back by giving her a free planetarium show or something.
You have a moon rock in the exhibit, don't you?
We do. It's under guard all the time. David Mestre, our planetarium director, has to be with it if it's not locked in a safe. And it's exciting to know that, you know, that I think it was Apollo 16 brought this particular rock back. Of course, the numbers that they had in Apollo 11 were just a small bunch of samples, and then they got bigger as they went on.
Wow.
But I was thinking about it today, Ron. You know, right now, Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins are about a day away from the moon. It's 240,000 miles from Cape Kennedy, Cape Canaveral to the moon. And it's a three-day trip. They're 2 days in. Imagine what they must have been feeling. And the cool thing about the Discovery Museum, Ron, is there's kids today that are going through a Challenger mission or a planetarium show. Someone of those kids is going to be an astronaut or work at NASA because it's happened over the years. And we might be looking at the first person to put their foot on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's exciting about the Discovery Museum.
They were fearless. They were smart. As I was saying, they were talented. I mean, these astronauts had the right stuff.
Yeah, literally. And you know, you look back on your life. We're both, you know, 60-ish, right? Yeah. And you look back, you know, what stood out? And of course, the tragedies stand out. But that day, the world was unified. And I get choked up thinking about it because I took pictures from the television of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon, and then went down to my dark room and developed them, and I still have one of them. And it's like, I get goosebumps just remembering that day, because you look up at the moon and you're thinking, how the hell did we do it? You know, we have cell phones. Yep. By the way, his just went off. That wasn't mine. And the computing capacity in my Samsung S7, whatever the heck it is, right?
Right.
Is multiple times greater than I have in the palms of my hand than all of NASA had at the time. And computers were those women we saw in the movie with slide rules.
It was incredible what they were able to do with that.
And what excuse have we had for treading water for the last 50 years. I'm not sure. But I know great advances have been made, and I'd love to tell you about the Discovery Magnet School next to us because it's really appropriate.
We'll get to that in a little bit. Let me bring in Professor J. Brett Bennington. Professor, are you there?
I'm here. Yes.
How are you, sir? Professor Bennington is professor of geology at Hofstra University. I had been mentioning with Bill about the moon rocks, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to bring you on. What is a moon rock made of?
Well, moon rocks are made of different minerals. As I tell my students, geology on the moon is actually much simpler than geology on Earth. There are basically three different kinds of moon rocks. There are more than that, but in general, moon rocks are either basalt, which is basically lava erupted out of the moon's interior. And if you look up at the moon at night, the dark, you know, seas that you see, you know, the face of the man on the moon, those are enormous impact craters that filled with lava flows. And the first several Apollo missions landed in those regions because it was flat and, you know, relatively easy to, you know, find a good place to land. So you have the dark material, the lava flows. The lighter areas of the moon are made out of a type of rock called anorthosite, which is sort of the original crust of the moon, and it forms the lunar highlands. And then much of the moon is covered by broken pieces of the first two kinds of rock that have been kind of cemented back together by the heat and pressure of impacts, and those rocks are called breccia. Mm. So three kinds of rocks: basalts, anorthosites, and breccias.
I remember the first time that I saw a moon rock, and I think I'm like everybody else. I couldn't help but it's a rock. I had to reach out and touch it. Did you do the same thing, Bill, or do you find others doing that at the Discovery Museum?
Actually, the one that we have is in a leucite pyramid, so you can't touch it.
Okay.
So it's lit. It's, you know, moon rocks are the rarest material on Earth. So there's a question of, you know, how valuable are they really? You know, we protect ours like it's incredibly important and valuable because we believe it is. But what makes a diamond valuable? There's a lot more diamonds than there are moon rocks on Earth.
Good point.
So I think, you know, we value it, but it's also what it symbolizes, right? I mean, we can talk about the chemistry of it, and it's exciting, but the human chemistry that created that way to get it here is just really amazing. And to learn the secrets that are locked in the moon will help us learn, I think, Professor, some of the secrets of our own planet, correct?
Well, absolutely. It turned out that moon rocks were the key to kind of understanding the history of the whole solar system. The problem we have on Earth is that because the Earth is such a dynamic planet with such an active crust, that the oldest rocks, the rocks that were produced on the Earth during the first half a billion years, are gone. They've been recycled. They've been destroyed by plate tectonics. So the early history of the solar system is unavailable on Earth, but it's available on the moon. And I could lecture you for an hour on all the incredible things that we learned from moon rocks. Just a couple of quick sound bites. We learned that the moon formed later than the Earth did, which helped us figure out the origin of the moon. We learned the ages of the big impact craters on the moon, which allowed us to determine that there was a very significant period of bombardment that affected all of the planets, including the Earth, about 400 million years or so after the solar system formed. By dating some of the other moon rocks, we were able to make a connection between the density of craters on the moon and the age of the surface with those craters. So, you know, you can tell the older parts of the moon have more craters. The younger parts of the moon have fewer craters. And we used that same crater counting technique to date the surfaces of Mars and Mercury and, you know, moons in the outer solar system. So we could do that, but we didn't have years that we could put on those crater counts until we got moon rocks back from the moon and were able to date those moon rocks.
Professor Bennington, I know that you're going to stay with us through the break. And when we come back, I'd like to ask you about what I was reading about on the plane yesterday, which is about how some countries and companies would like to colonize the moon in the future to bring back minerals and other deposits. I found it to be a fascinating article. But if you could stay just where you are for just a moment, because I know Bill has to leave in just a second, and I just want to give you an opportunity to let everyone know what's going on with the Discovery Museum this Saturday and what it's going to cost them, which is a word that everybody likes.
Well, Saturday is free for everyone.
There you go.
The 20th of July is the day that Neil and Buzz landed on the moon and Michael Collins stood faithfully his position, and we're going to celebrate it. So if you want your kids to have a little of the feel that 63 and 64-year-olds have felt, come on and reenact it. You know, the great thing about the Discovery Museum and the Discovery Magnet School next door is we're making the astronauts and the engineers and the doctors and the solar installers of the future. And we'd love to have everybody come and visit, because you'll leave a changed person, especially if you see a planetarium show or a lecture on science on a sphere. And that change is part of how we get ourselves ready to continue to discover, to continue to explore. The Discovery Magnet School, where we teach, thanks to a NASA grant, kids from kindergarten through eighth grade rocket science.
Mm.
Imagine. So at the graduation, when I spoke there just 2 weeks ago, the kids were saying, oh, I understand that. That's just rocket science.
Precocious, aren't they?
And it's true for them. They've grown up with it. And as of all of us in 50 years, it's a lot to celebrate.
Bill Finch, thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Ron.
It's a pleasure. Professor Bennington, sit tight. We'll get to you in just one moment. You are listening to The Full Story on WSHU. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks for being part of our show today. And if you would like to share some of your memories about that extraordinary time in the 60s and the early 70s when NASA and the Apollo missions were so important in our lives, please email them to us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. And if you're the son or the daughter of someone who worked on the missions, we would really enjoy hearing from you. As you know, the race to the moon was a collaborative effort, and many of the men and women who put us on Tranquility Base came from our region. A little bit earlier today, my colleague, WSHU reporter Davis Donovan, spoke with one of those men, Ed Whitman. Ed is an engineer who worked on the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, at the Grumman plant on Long Island. And here's their conversation.
Ed Whitman is here with us. Ed was an engineer who worked on communications between the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, and the Command Service Module. Ed, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, okay, I'm very glad to be here.
Thanks. So, Ed, you were about 26 years old when you started working at Grumman in 1964. What was it like there back then?
Well, one of the things I remember when I first started, I worked for a small company before I came to Grumman, but I remember the excitement in the Bethpage area, New York. And to get into the parking lot, they had a gigantic parking lot. And when I pulled in, I remembered everybody was backed in like. So I figured, well, let me back in too. I got there very early. And then I realized why you had to back into the spots, because at the change of every shift, let's say I worked from like 8 to 5 or something, it was like the Daytona 500. Because everybody pulled out of their spots to get on South Oyster Bay Road. And if you had to start backing out of your spot, you could be there all day. Anyway, on South Oyster Bay Road, which is a big road around here in Bethpage, that basically leads up to the expressway or the parkway, they had dozens of Nassau County police patrolmen directing traffic, because of all the cars moving, coming in and going out. And they even had a railroad stop on by Grumman, which would take people east or west. Anyway, the first plant I worked for was what they call Plant 25, which is still there. It's a very large building on South Oyster Bay Road. And I was on the engineering floor. And when I, on the third floor where I was amazed when I came into the floor that was the engineering floor. It reminded me of a gigantic Costco warehouse, which, of course, was not the, an idea at that time. It had a 30-foot ceiling, and all you could see were desks and rows, that were speckled with hundreds of engineers in white shirts, ties, and, of course, pocket protectors. And some of the pocket protectors had little buttons or little pins on the different programs they worked on, the LEM, EA-6B, and other aircraft programs.
So
it was wall-to-wall shirts.
So with your work, what were you doing on the LEM and the command service module? Tell me a little about your contribution.
Okay. All right. I did some initial analysis work in that building, but then because of my experience with antennas, I was transferred again to Plant 14, which is a little bit south of the main complex. And there I basically worked with a senior engineer. We designed this, it was called an X-band transponder antenna. Basically, it was on the top of the LEM, and it provided digital communications between the LEM and the command service module that was orbiting the lunar excursion module.
That's the one that Michael Collins was on, right?
Yes, that's the one that Michael Collins. And the antenna was about 12 inches long, and it was basically a Y-shaped arrangement of waveguides. And it came up, and it gave a hemispherical coverage, in other words, like a dome-type coverage to the command service module when it radiated. And I worked in that particular building. They had a chamber called an anechoic chamber, and they had black pyramidal rubberized cones there that basically created an echo-free chamber. So we would do a number of tests and coverage and what they call standing wave ratio to make sure everything was okay. And we were able to tweak the antennas a little bit. And everything that was done, I would write down in my notebook. And later, we would put all the drawings and gather all the documentations and the test data. And then we would send it over to the Grumman's records department. And they would, in turn, send the package over to production to manufacture. And, I mean, there was so much paperwork involved with the lunar excursion module. They often used to kid around and say if they stacked all the documentation end-to-end, you could probably walk to the moon.
So,
but that was primarily the actual technical work I did for about 9 months. Mm-hmm. And it was very exciting. And I loved working in the anechoic chamber because it was so totally quiet in there.
So today, when you see footage from the lunar landing, you know, you see the module making its way to the surface of the moon and touching down. What goes through your mind?
I remember there was one plant in Grumman, in the main complex. I walked through one day, and I came into this gigantic area, and they had a mock-up of the lunar excursion module, and they had it on a crane. And what they would actually do is lift it up maybe about 10 or 20 feet and then drop it on different surfaces. And sometimes the surface had like beach sand. Then it would be a little bit harder. And basically what they were doing was checking how, when the lunar excursion module fell, structurally how it would stand up on the different densities of the moon, because at that time we had no idea when the LEM landed if it would fall into something like quicksand, or would be like landing on a sidewalk on a very hard surface. And fortunately, as you see in a lot of the films, it was like more like a beach density. I think what was most exciting, you felt like you were working in a science fiction movie, because no one knew what would happen, the orbits and what they would encounter. I mean, there were modules before this one, but they basically orbited the moon. And I think the best time was, of course,
on July 20th, 1969, when you actually got to see the LEM land on the moon and, of course, return safely back to Earth.
Thank you, Davis, and also Ed Whitman, who just gave me one of my new favorite lines, wall-to-wall shirts. That says it all right there. With us still is Professor J. Brett Beddington, who's professor of geology at Hofstra University. Professor, I appreciate your patience and your time, because I just wanted to ask you this one specific question, which I found fascinating. As I mentioned, I was on a plane yesterday. I was flying home. And I was reading about the race to colonize space, specifically the moon, and how the major countries were going to do this. And one of the reasons is that some of the countries want to mine the moon. And I have to ask you, is this feasible? I mean, what is there on the moon that we would want or need?
Well, it's an interesting question. And the answer depends on what you want to mine stuff for. There isn't much on the moon that would be worth bringing back to Earth. The Earth and the moon are made out of essentially the same kinds of materials. And on the Earth, you know, we've identified concentrations of raw materials that we find useful. And the moon is relatively depleted in valuable things. So where mining the moon is going to be economically feasible and useful is to support space exploration. And the big problem with or the big expense of space exploration is getting material off the surface of the Earth into Earth orbit and beyond. We occupy this tremendous gravity well, and lifting material up into space is hugely expensive. It's like $10,000 a pound or something. Mm. Getting stuff off the moon is a fraction of that. I mean, the amount of energy you need to get into lunar orbit from the surface of the moon is a fraction of what it takes to get off the Earth. So if you want to explore outer space and you need to build rocket ships and you need to generate fuel for those rocket ships, getting that material from the moon instead of from the Earth would be a tremendous cost savings. And the moon, you know, potentially could provide us with titanium and iron and aluminum. And then the components of rocket fuel, oxygen and hydrogen. We have detected deposits of water in the pole, you know, in craters, sitting in craters on the poles of the moon. And it looks like there's a significant amount of water. And water, if you electrolytically split it into its component, hydrogen and oxygen, hydrogen and oxygen are the two things that you combine to make, you know, for rocket fuel. So, so where mining the moon is going to be useful is probably in the continued exploration of the solar system.
Professor, I don't have enough time with you today. I have to cut this short, but will you come back in the future and we could have a much more in-depth conversation?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Professor J. Brett Beddington, professor of geology at Hofstra University. Thank you, Professor.
My pleasure.
Two more guests for you this segment. Larry Youngblood is joining us. He was the engineer responsible for testing, maintenance, and integration of the communication subsystem with all the other systems on the LEM, including the intercommunication system, TV and biomedical systems. And Ray LeCon is the former Grumman VP and director of the Lunar Excursion Module Data Reduction System. That's a mouthful, huh? He's the person basically who made sure all the equipment worked before sending the astronauts into space. Ray, that was one heck of an important job.
Thank you. It was. It was an interesting job. I've been selected on the panel that is going to speak on Saturday with the assignment of explaining the different challenges that Grumman faced along the way to a successful flight to the moon. And that job is an interesting one because it takes me back to many years of work at Grumman when we were not entirely certain along the way that we would be successful. I think many people thought it was going to be easy, but we found out it wasn't a cakewalk at all, and it required enormous diligence and hard work on the part of so many different people, predominantly the people who worked directly on the vehicle in our shops. My job was quite different because running the data station, it turned out that all I did was work in a very nice air-conditioned environment, probably the best in the plant, and the work that I did was strictly to make certain that everything that was being tested on the LEM proved that it was suitable for flight. Amongst our challenges, if I can mention just a few, were the weight growth. It was a very difficult issue because as the design process went forward, and by the way, the gentleman who designed just about every aspect of the LEM was a man named Tom Kelly. He's known as the father of the LEM, and he clearly deserves the praise for having made it happen. And, of course, Tom Kelly was trying desperately to keep the weight within limits that were preset, and those limits were dictated by the amount of thrust that Wernher von Braun, who was the head of the rocket development at that time, could produce. Mm. And it was forever a challenge between what poor Tom Kelly had reached as a weight and what Wernher von Braun could support as a weight. And at times it really seemed like we didn't have enough thrust to get us off the ground, and that would require us to do some pretty amazing changes to the LEM. We had what we called super weight improvement campaigns, which required that we go back and re-engineer just about every surface of every component in the LEM to make it lighter than it was in its original design.
So, Ray, I'm just going to jump in here for a second because sure. I am limited on time today, and I would just like to bring in Larry for a second because, Larry, you know, when I tell my kid that his iPhone and his iPad has more computing power than what you guys had to work with back then, he looks at me like I'm from Mars. What you accomplished was incredible.
You're right about that. When you consider what the whole LEM computer system and communication system, it's probably more in your car today than we had in the vehicle. And we had a lot of different challenges. I know Ed brought up about the antennas, and we worked with that, and I worked with on the swipe program, taking even equipment and drilling extra holes in the mounting bracket just to reduce those ounces. So we had a lot of challenging projects at the beginning, things that were unknown to us. One of the things was with the gravity or 1/6 gravity on the moon, we were concerned with the erectable antenna. That's that big antenna that looks like a big umbrella. And we were concerned whether or not it would open. And a lot of time and testing on Earth in various different conditions found it to be acceptable. And, of course, it did work on the moon.
So the
challenges that we had was, since it would be the first time various connectors would be connected and disconnected, one for the antenna and for the TV camera, there was a concern of what they call cold welding, which in extreme temperatures and high vacuums was unconcerned whether or not these connectors would actually work and detach. So we had to come up with special type spring-loaded contacts to make sure that it did work in those conditions.
I know my time again is limited today, and I just want to mention that Ed Whitman, who we heard from a little bit earlier, Mr. Lacan, Mr. Youngblood, are all going to be part of a panel which is organized by the Montauk Observatory and Stony Brook University. Now, the panel is going to be this Saturday. A lot going on this Saturday in our region. It's going to be at the Avram Theater at Stony Brook, Southampton. If you would want more information about this, you can find it on our website, which is WSHU.org. Roy, Larry, and Ed Whitman, who was on with us a little bit earlier, thank you for your time, and I'm sure you're going to have a wonderful turnout for the speech this Saturday. I look forward to hearing more about this in the future. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you would like to join in today's conversation, you can email us. We are at tfs@wshu.org, or you can find us on Twitter. And you may know that one. We're at Full Story WSHU. This is the Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. One last break. We'll be right back. You're part of the Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Glad you're with us today as we take a look at the 50th anniversary of landing and walking on the moon and the role that the men and women in our region had in one of the greatest achievements in human history. Now, we have a few more guests for you. Ed O'Connor is one of them. Ed, you have to listen to this, devoted 48 years of his life to working on the space program, working at Hamilton Standard in Windsor Locks, Connecticut. Nowadays, Ed is a volunteer at the Connecticut Science Center in Hartford. Hi, Ed. How are you?
Doing well.
It's great to speak with you. And just to be clear, in your long career, you worked on the lunar mission, but you also worked on the space shuttle, the International Space Station, Skylab, and a lot more. Is that right?
Skylab and going beyond that also into some of the future life support systems, yes.
That's quite the career. That's amazing.
It's been a fun, it's been an interesting and exciting career.
Can we start with the moon mission? How did you get involved with that? What did you work on?
A couple of different things. Well, you start with it. When I first started there, I was in a project group, systems project group oriented, and then supplying the life support system for the lunar module. Worked on that for about a year and a half, and then I got into doing a number of other things, working on a number of other programs, life support systems, that were going on at that time. There were a number of them at that time, besides the lunar module, which was going on, and that was getting ready for landing on the moon. There was also, like, we were in that era about a biosatellite, sending a monkey up and understanding him happened to be one of the things that was going on. There was some other military space stations that they were concepting and wanted to get a look at that time, too. And that's sort of what the era was back then.
Mm. A life support system. So you were engaged in making sure that the astronauts survived.
Yes. And a matter of fact, at Hamilton, we had two aspects of that. One of the aspects was the cabin itself, and then I can allude to the module. How do you keep them alive within a cabin environment? Beyond that, then we also had the life support systems on the spacesuits and the spacesuits later on years. Now, on a life support system, you provide some of the same functions, except you're connected, you're small, and you're really not connected to a large mass or a large volume, if you will, to help you work your way through that. So you had two different sets of technologies going on at the same time.
You know, the one thing that over the last few weeks, as I've read all the news articles and I've seen the news coverage on TV or heard on the radio, is how many people were actively involved in this throughout the country? Because I think some people had the misconception that this was just based down in Houston or Florida, something like that. This was straight through the United States.
Well, yeah. Well, as an example, just let me tell you that some of the jobs that were awarded within our area locally, okay? Specifically, we had the life support system on a lunar module. We had the suit. Pratt & Whitney had the fuel cells on the Apollo Command module. And they were supposed to have fuel cells on the lunar module, but they really decided that for a 49-hour mission, they were better off with batteries. You had parts going on the inertial guidance platform for the lunar module. Plus, all the work that was going on. And it's only one small segment of it all. Mm. I couldn't even tell you how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of people were involved in that job.
Are you sad that the U.S. isn't as actively engaged in the space program as we once were?
Yes, yes. I'm on the path of looking forward to what we can do next. I've read in the last couple of days that they're thinking about heading back to the moon before we head to Mars, and that's a first step back again, going to it. I mean, I don't mean backwards. I mean going back to where we were. And then from that, use that to get the technologies that's going to take us to the Mars mission. And I think that's something that we need to be focusing on. It's the growth of society, the future society, besides, you know, where are we headed?
Mm. Ed, talk to us about that particular period of time, because there are those who say now that to save the Earth from climate change, we would need to devote resources and brain power that's basically equivalent to what you did, putting a man on the moon, or maybe even to the Manhattan Project. So what was it about that time that was so unique, and can that be replicated?
At that time, it was, first of all, it was Kennedy who decided that this is what's going to happen. And then it took what he wanted to do to make that happen. And there was that era when he proclaimed that, there was a general excitement about looking forward to making this happen. I mean, politically, there were times along the way where that emphasis generally shifted, but he still maintained that goal, and that was carried on. And that's what allowed us to get there. So you will run into the same situation again on anything else you're trying to do.
It was that famous American can-do spirit, right?
Oh, you best believe it. And yes, we went and made it happen. And the we, is, as I said, a huge number of people as part of that we.
Right. Finally, Ed, do you ever let it slip that when you're talking with the kids at the Connecticut Science Center that you were one of those who helped put a man on the moon?
Generally not with the kids. The parents, yes. The kids they're trying to focus on one set of things, and their priorities aren't there yet. But what you try to do, and we try to do, is teach them, get them interested in science itself, show them the various aspects of science, provide some depth in some of the areas so that they can then start thinking scientifically and looking for the scientific goals.
And your thoughts about going to Mars, I'm assuming you're all for it?
Yes. Yes, I think it's the next stop. Recognize, we are part of a small, small world and universe. And if you take a look at what came out of the Hubble telescope, the number of planets that can support some, and some, when I say planets, I'm talking about in the universe, thousands of light years away. But in that whole range, there are many planets, billions as a matter of fact, that have the capability to support life. So you're looking at, yes, we're progressing towards that. I think we need to take our steps towards in that regard.
Ed O'Connor, a pleasure, sir. Thanks for your time today and for everything that you did.
Thank you.
And we're going to end our discussion today with Joshua Stoff, who's the curator of the Cradle of Aviation Museum and Education Center. The museum is in Garden City, and appropriately, it is on Charles Lindbergh Boulevard. Josh, how are you? Thanks for being with us. I'm fine, sir. And also joining us is Dan Burbank. Dan Burbank is a NASA astronaut. He's a retired astronaut from Tolland, Connecticut. He's now a senior technical fellow at Collins Aerospace in Windsor Locks, Connecticut. And Collins Aerospace is part of UTC. Dan, thanks for being with us. I'm sorry, do you like Dan or do you like Captain Burbank? Which is best?
No, I think Dan is great. Thanks, Ron, and very happy to be with you today.
Dan, it's our pleasure. And I have to, I'm so happy that you're with us because as an astronaut, I have to ask, I don't know how old you are, but were you inspired by what happened back in 1969?
Yeah, so 50 years ago, this Saturday, it was a week before my eighth birthday. So I was young then, but was certainly aware of what was going on and actually stayed up late that night, got the folks to let me stay up late to actually watch that first spacewalk on this other planetary body. So for me, that definitely inspired me to always follow the space program. When I was a kid, I didn't want to be an astronaut, and I think it's probably more a factor that it never occurred to me that was something I could do. So I became a Coast Guard engineer and pilot, and it wasn't until, you know, later in life when I was, you know, already had a couple thousand hours of Coast Guard missions under my belt, and that it even occurred to me to apply. And I was fortunate enough to get to spend 22 years with NASA, flying on space shuttles, flying on the International Space Station, and also most recently on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft 2 space station. And now I get a chance to work with the company that has been enabling a lot of the great missions that NASA has done and is working really hard right now to enable a return to the moon and to further destinations, as you've heard.
Dan, you and I are just about the same age, and what is it about that moment? And I can remember it like it was yesterday, sitting in front of that little black and white TV, late at night, eyes barely open, and just glued to what was happening. It was an incredible moment.
Yeah, and I, you know, for folks our age, you know, it certainly made a big impression. But then there were folks that were older than us that were in school or getting ready to leave high school and go on to college. And a huge segment of our youth back in that day, and arguably all across the world, were so inspired that they pursued careers in science and technology and aerospace. Some found their way to eventually to flying on spacecraft and contributing to that. I think it really was this massive infusion of excitement in technology and engineering that that helped American society across the board, and of course the entire world. You know, 500 million people. I think we're pretty aware that knew that this was a monumental undertaking. This was a watershed moment for humanity. And I think back then we probably all thought that by now we'd have 1,000 people living in space, and we're not quite there yet. I mean, it's a really hard thing to do. We do it very successfully and have had for, 20 years now, continuous presence in low Earth orbit on board a 1,000,000-pound mass space station. And it's allowed us to get smarter and smarter on the technology, smarter and smarter about how to keep humans safe and productive in space, so that now we can contemplate in a very short order now going back to the moon, but not like we did back then, on a permanent basis, and learn to live off the land there, and so that we can turn those kinds of skills, which will become critical for deep space destinations, into something that's part of our toolbox.
Josh, there are many, many wonderful celebrations going on this weekend across our region. What are you doing at the Cradle of the Aviation Museum and Education Center that you think is unique?
Well, we are kind of unique in that we're a local history museum, just to deal with aviation spaceflight as it pertains to Long Island. And fortunately, one of the companies that was here and still here is Grumman Aerospace. And they built the lunar module for the Apollo program. So we actually have the best collection in the world of lunar modules. We have two complete original ones, plus two cockpits and many smaller parts. So Long Island was one of the focal points of the Apollo program back in the 1960s. And we've got this great collection to show off. We've been running a year-long celebration on Apollo. And this Saturday, for the 50th anniversary, we have a Moonfest going on. We have, if people have never met an astronaut and kids want to, come down this Saturday and you'll meet an astronaut. We have three local Long Island astronauts who've all flown on the space shuttle who are going to be here. We're going to be running kids' activities all day. We have a domed theater. We're going to be showing the CNN movie on Apollo 11, which is great, running that all day. We have moon buggy races, model rocket launches, virtual reality experiences of walking on the moon. And it's just going to be a fun, unusual, action-packed day. And hopefully, if things go right, at 4:17 p.m., we're going to try to reenact a lunar landing with a one-third scale lunar module. We're going to lower from the ceiling in the museum and land 50 years to the second right here in the museum. So it's going to really be a fun day.
Josh, you ever have anyone come up to you and say, you fit how many people into that lunar module? Are you kidding me?
From the outside, it looks kind of big, but when you look inside the cockpit, it's pretty tight in there. And on the later Apollo missions, they lived on the moon for about 3 days and they slept in there. And they had two hammocks, one beneath the others, and they had to live in there and eat and do everything they had to do. And it's a pretty small space. And what's even more remarkable is when you think about Apollo 13, you had three people living in there for a week, and they were shoulder to shoulder. So I'm not sure. I guess that's what kept them warm.
Dan, I have to say, it probably kept you guys on Weight Watchers or Atkins or something like that, right?
Well, there's a couple aspects of that, I think. So I would say that the lunar module, although it might have been relatively small, the Russian Soyuz spacecraft quite a bit smaller still. And we spend a couple of days in that sometimes when we go to International Space Station. So, I would mention one other thing. So the lunar module, remarkable, remarkable bit of technology, incredible. And it's actually two spacecraft in one. The ascent and descent elements that while mated affect the landing on the moon, and then of course the ascent piece itself is what comes back. It serves as an airlock, of course, for the spacewalks there. Our company, back in the day, Hamilton Standard made the life support system in that lunar module. So during Apollo 13, for example, nominally it would support the crew while they're there on the surface of the moon. But then during Apollo 13, that was repurposed to provide enough life-saving oxygen production and CO2 scrubbing, just enough to get that Apollo 13 crew safely back home when they had the problem on board the command service module.
Dan, I'm going to ask you this question. I'd also like to get Josh's thoughts about it also. Are you happy with where the U.S. is right now in terms of our space program? And if not, what would you like to see happen in the future?
Yeah, so I'll take the first shot at that. So, you know, I heard your discussions with Ed, and I've been really, really close to the space program, both from the operations side at NASA, flying on the vehicles. But, you know, astronauts, frankly, don't do as much flying as they do engineering. So our real jobs, you know, when we work within the astronaut corps, supporting the missions that are up there and the future missions and doing a lot of the hardware tests, the development, everything from, you know, concepting how you'll operate on other planetary bodies, how you'll go back and on a permanent basis live on the moon, for example, to actually doing the detailed engineering to actually, you know, bring those dreams to reality. So I've seen it up close. I've seen it as we built the International Space Station. I've, you know, lived up there for half a year and done the science that we do on there, much of which is geared towards keeping humans, again, safe and productive in space so that we can do the kinds of missions that we all dream about. I think that we as a country have some monumental, we as a species have a monumental challenges. Some of them we create for ourselves, you know, and from an environmental standpoint, we have an awful lot of strife and difficult kinds of issues that, again, a lot of it is self-imposed. When you go to space, nothing strikes you more than looking back at this planet Earth and seeing just how thin that tiny envelope of air is that keeps all of us safe and productive, and every bit of history that's ever occurred, every one of all your loved ones, so, you know, everything that's ever happened in human history occurred in that tiny, tiny little 100-kilometer, envelope of air. I really believe that we should become a multiplanetary species. It's a really hard thing to be able to do that. I think for the amount of money that we spend in the space program, which is for each taxpayer in the United States, is a really, really small amount of money, $60 or so per taxpayer. And for that, we have a million-pound mass space station bigger than a football field. We have three brand-new spacecraft and three brand-new rockets to take those spacecraft into outer space, you know, with the SpaceX Falcon 9 and its Crew Dragon, with the CST-100 Boeing Starliner and its version of the Atlas V, that both of those vehicles will allow crews to get to and from the International Space Station. And then with the entire architecture for the deep space exploration, which is the Orion spacecraft, the SLS rocket, and we have a whole host of others that are out there right now in industry right now, coming up with ideas on how we can reduce the cost of access to space such that we can fundamentally change the economics so that it will be reasonable to build and imagine and build on a short term, relatively short time scale, the assembly of a scientific outpost at the South Pole of the moon to extract resources from the lunar regolith to learn how to live off the land.
Dan, I got to hold you right there, and I could listen to you for hours. Trust me. I just want to give Josh, because we only have a few seconds left.
No,
not at all. Please. Josh, how can people find out more about what you're doing this weekend?
Look on our website, cradleofaviation.org, and list everything going on, and it's going to be a fun day, good way to commemorate it.
Josh, thank you, curator of the Cradle of Aviation Museum and Education Center. We'll get you back in the future. And Dan Burbank, retired NASA astronaut from Tolland, Connecticut. Captain Burbank, thank you, sir. I appreciate everything you've done, and I'd love to get you back on in the future with us also, if you don't mind.
Happy to do that. Ron, great to spend time with you, Josh. I'm glad that we could have a chance to share this great opportunity together. Love to come down and see you.
Thanks to all of you. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.